Hi, welcome to Linux Demystified. Hopefully, after watching this talk, you'll be able to understand a little bit more about what Linux is, who uses it, and how you can use it. So what is Linux? Linux is an operating system. An operating system is basically a bridge between hardware and applications. So an operating system handles everything for you. It's a complete framework for running your computer. So it handles process control. It handles programs that run. It handles networking, how you connect to the internet, how you connect to other computers. It handles peripherals, handles your keyboard, your mouse, other input and output devices, printers, your monitor. It handles file system access, so how you fetch files from your hard drive, how you save files. And it is written in C. So the same language that you've been using to write all your problem sets this year is the language that Linux itself is written in. So C is a very, very powerful language that can go straight to the hardware and deal with very low-level operations. So a little bit of history. What is GNU Linux? So the GNU project was founded in 1983. It was founded to create, in their own words, a sufficient body of free software to get along without any software that's not free. In other words, create a free operating system. Create a way to run your computer free of all restrictions that other companies had placed on their operating systems. So the Linux kernel was the last component of the free operating system to be completed. And it wasn't actually completed by members of the GNU project. It was a third-party kernel. And it was added to the GNU project to form a complete operating system. So although it's commonly shortened to Linux in the public and in media, the Linux is actually just the kernel, not the complete operating system. So as the GNU project likes to see it, they have the GNU mascot being the entire thing, and the Linux mascot, the penguin, sort of being the last component of this GNU operating system. So they favor the name GNU Linux as opposed to just Linux. And GNU is not completely unfamiliar to you guys. You've been compiling your code all year with GCC. That stands for GNU C compiler. And you've been debugging code with GDB. That's the GNU debugger. So all these things go into creating a complete operating system. And most of them came from the GNU project. So what does GNU actually mean? GNU stands for GNU's not Unix. So it's a cruel programmer's joke to create a recursive acronym. And it means that GNU Linux, or Linux, is Unix-like, which means it's similar to Unix, but it is not Unix. Unix was an earlier operating system that the Mac operating systems actually descended directly from. And given that Linux is Unix-like, and the Mac operating system descended directly from Unix, there's a lot of similarities, which is why a lot of these things that we talk about you being able to do on Linux, like SSHing, you can just open up your Mac terminal and do directly. Whereas on Windows, which came from a completely separate branch of operating systems, you would have to download software like PuTTY to interface with these Linux systems. The Free Software Foundation is a foundation that was created, as the name suggests, to support free software. The foundation employs people to write software for the GNU project. So it employs people to write this free software for the GNU project. So we've been talking about Linux being free, but what does it actually mean to be free? So the first thing is that Linux is $0. $0, 0 cents, it is free. You go, you can use the Linux kernel, and it's free. You don't have to pay for it. But that's not the real freedom we're talking about. When we talk about Linux being free, we're really talking about freedom as in free speech. So this would be the classic analogy, free as in speech and not as in beer. Free speech, in English we use the same word for both uses of free. Most other languages don't, but we're stuck with that problem when we're speaking in English. So there's basically four basic principles to software freedom. The first is the freedom to use the software for any purpose. That means you can use it for your education, you can use it to create a product, to sell, you can use it for anything you want. And you can change the software to suit your needs. That's the second principle. So you can modify the software accordingly so it does what you want it to do. The next is to share the software you made with your friends and neighbors. In other words, you shouldn't be restricted in sharing what you wrote with other people. So if you wrote some great software, you should have no problem sending it to everybody in the world. And the last is the freedom to share the changes you made. So this goes with it. You can make changes and share those changes with the world as well. You don't have to just share the initial software. And this is codified in what's called the GNU General Public License, or GPL. A lot of people mistakenly think that things like this, freedom, as in you can do what you want with it, goes against copyright law and what copyright law is intended for. And they actually call this stuff copyleft, as a play on copyright. But the whole way this survives is because of our copyright law system. So the fact that we have copyright law to protect these licenses, to protect these freedoms, is the only reason why it survives. So contrary to how a lot of people see it, this whole free software movement, the Free Software Foundation, things like Wikipedia that's free, these do not go against copyright. They work within the limits of copyright law to ensure that these freedoms are secured. So Linux itself isn't very usable. It's just a kernel, a basic operating system, which is why we have Linux distributions. So Linux is available in many, many distributions on a ton of platforms. And they're all customized for different purposes. So we have personal computers, netbooks, other desktops that you choose to install Linux on, that mostly run Ubuntu. Ubuntu is a very accessible distribution. It's easy for newcomers to Linux. It's very graphical. It handles stuff for you. It comes pre-installed with a lot of things. But we also have distributions like the one that runs on Android cell phones. So that's built off Linux as well. We have the CS50 Cloud as an operating system. It runs Fedora. We have toaster ovens that run Linux, PlayStation 3, game systems, whatever. They all run their own versions of Linux. And they're all built on top of this Linux kernel. So the base of Linux is this idea of ultimate flexibility and control. So when you run an operating system like Mac's operating system or Microsoft Windows, you're using software, but you don't actually know how the software was written. So you only know what they tell you and what you observe. Linux, on the other hand, you have access to the complete source of the Linux kernel and to the entire operating system, which means you know exactly how everything's run, and you can control how everything's run. So now let's talk about some of the general principles of Linux. The first one is that less is more, or no news is good news. When things work, there's nothing, you don't really see things happen. When you copy a file, the only way you know it's copied is you get your terminal prompt and nothing was output. When you delete a file, it's just deleted. No, are you sure? Do you want to move to the recycle bin? Do you want to restore? It's just gone. And this principle allows you to really tell when things go wrong as opposed to just when things happen. And since we're usually concerned with when things go wrong, it tends to help things out a lot. The next principle is the principle of small programs that do one thing really well. So you'll have a program that does a tiny thing, but does that thing really well. So there can be options, customizations, but fundamentally it performs one task. And this means that other programs can use this program to perform that given task. If you wrote a program that displays files very nicely in a very clean output format, if you're writing a new program and want to display a file, there's no point to writing it again. You can just use this small program chunk, or this small program to do it for you. Another principle is that almost everything is open source. Now, this is contrary to the initial GNU project where everything was open source, but it's necessary to let Linux function in the real world. So a lot of printer manufacturers, for example, release drivers so that your computer can work with their printers and don't want to release the source code for these drivers. So they will release compiled versions of these drivers that are not actually open source, but that will work with Linux. But in general, almost everything you'd run on Linux is open source. Another principle is that input and output to programs is plain text. And this goes back to the idea of the command line interface. So this, you're presented with a text prompt, and it's where the real meat stuff happens in Linux. The real stuff happens on the command line interface through plain text input and plain text output. And what this means is that it's really easy to automate things, for example, cron jobs that you can set to run every month, every year, every day, that will do a given task. Let's say you're running a website, and every day you want to fetch data from this other source. You can set a cron job to do that for you automatically every day. And since input and output is plain text, it's easy to record output and give it specified input. Imagine if you had to tell your program, so move the mouse to the upper left corner, click the go button, move to this text box, type something in, then click go back there. It would be a big problem. So the command line interface allows you to automate things like this. Some more principles. Linux is built from its core to be a multi-user computing environment with advanced file permissions. So this is something that is different than the way most people use their personal computers. Most people that have Windows and Mac tend to have one user account, or maybe if they're ambitious, two or three. But a lot of people tend to just ignore it, create one account for their family using the computer, and just work from there. Linux, on the other hand, is designed to be able to run with a lot of users at the same time. So, for example, when you SSH to the CS50 cloud, you're all connecting to the same computer, and you're all logged on at the same time. To support this, Linux has a really robust file permission scheme. So this means you can set exactly what each person can do with your file, whether they can read your file, write to the file, execute your file. And you can control this for yourself, for a group of people, for specific people, for the world. When you created websites and you were hosting them on the CS50 cloud, you used chmod to change file permissions. This allowed the entire world to read your JavaScript or your HTML so that they could access it in their browsers. Another principle is that everything is a file. Everything is a file. This means devices are files. Processes are files. It's a really strange system when you think about it, but it makes things standardized and very easy to access. So if you have a standard method for accessing things as files, you can get direct access to things like the hard drive and processes that are running on your computer. You don't need to use these as much when you're writing regular software. When you did your problem sets, you obviously don't need to access things like other processes running or your hard drive. But when you're writing an operating system, when you're writing the Linux kernel, it was a great design decision to put everything as a file so that you could have access to these things if you wanted. Other things, Control Z, Control D, Control C. These are sort of standardized ways for getting out of something. If you get stuck, you can usually try one of these three combinations and get out. And finally, if you don't know something, read the manual. So everything is contained in this manual that you get by typing man and then a command. It might look esoteric at the beginning. It might look really hard to comprehend, but everything is there if you need it. It contains every option that you can pass to a given program and explains it in full. So it's really great. Nothing goes undocumented, and everything's documented. Almost everything is documented in this standardized format. Okay, where is everything? So everything on the Linux system is located in this root directory, this slash directory. So if you did cd /, that would take you to this root directory. And you'd see a bunch of different directories, different folders here. Now, some of these are actual files, and some of these are virtual files. So, for example, the bin directory contains binaries. That's where your programs are. The boot directory contains stuff that the system needs to boot up. Etsy, that contains configuration files. All your home directories, all your documents, everything that you've been doing is located in home. Proc actually contains processes and stuff like this. So everything that you can get on your Linux system is accessed through this root directory, and everything is located there. And this includes actual files and pseudo files. So this is just another view of it, a directory tree in a sense. You can see that the MNT mount directory contains CD-ROMs and floppy disk if you had them. Home contains Rick, Anna, and Emmy and Bob's home directories. Etsy contains configuration files. This is just another way of viewing the document tree. Your home directory. This is where you live. This is when you SSH to a server, when you log on to your system, where you end up. And it's where you store your documents, store other things you're working on. You can store programs you write there. And it's in essence, your home base. You can write whatever you want there, save whatever you want there, delete whatever you want there. And we access it by this shortcut, which is the tilde and the slash. That's exactly equivalent of writing the complete path to your home directory. So on the cloud, if I were to write tilde slash, it would be the same exact thing of writing slash home slash Cushman2, which is my cloud username. The next thing is that the Linux file tree is flexible, which means that we don't need to give a complete path to everything every time we want to access something. So we have the slash, which is the root directory, which everything can be accessed from. We have dot slash, which means my current directory. So when you compile a program and you're running it, you'd use dot slash and then the program name. That says, go to my current directory and fetch the program to run. We also have dot dot slash, which means go up one directory in the directory tree. And we have symlinks. So these symlinks basically allow the computer to associate two different files or directories. So in your text problem set, in your spell checker problem set, you had what seemed like a regular directory that contained all the texts that you were supposed to spell check. In fact, the texts were located in a different directory somewhere else on the system, and they were symlinked, virtually linked, from your directory to that directory. Which means that if something changed on that directory, it would be updated in every user's texts directory in their pset. This is great because it requires you not to have to copy things over and over again, and also to create easier paths to things. So you could put, for example, a symlink in your home directory from a directory in your home directory to this other directory with a long path that you don't want to type all the time. So you can just do cd into this symlinked directory, and it will take you to this other directory magically. And you won't even be able to tell. It'll do it seamlessly. Next is user configurations. So configuration is generally contained in hidden files. And by convention, hidden files start with a dot. And the reason we start things with a dot is because when we do ls, which lists the working directory, lists the contents of the working directory, it won't show us stuff that's hidden, stuff that contains a dot. So we use these files or directories. You can have hidden directories that start with a dot. We use these for configuration. So when you run nano, the text editor, by default, it's just a text editor that shows you white text, doesn't do anything. But through our configuration, through the nano configuration, we allow it to have syntax highlighting and other things. We use, when you use Mercurial to save the source code of your problem set, revision control, the information for that is stored in a hidden directory in your problem set folder. In general, they're contained in the home directory, but when they're associated with a specific folder, often they're contained there. All right, so we've spoken a lot about Linux in general, and now let's touch on some actual useful Linux programs. So here's a list of what is arguably some of the most well-known Linux programs. You are probably familiar with a couple of these. You may recognize Emacs or Vim as text editors, chmod, which changes your file permissions. You'll notice that all of these do pretty much one thing. Wget, for example, downloads a file. That's it. It doesn't display it. It doesn't process it. It downloads a file. Now, it has customizations, so you can save the file with a specific name or do all these other sort of things associated with downloading a file. But at its core, it just downloads a file. So we have all these other programs. We have Echo, which just outputs text that you give it. We have Cat, which outputs a file. Head and Tail, which output the beginning and end of a file. More, which displays a file. Less, which is a play on the philosophy less is more. Less is actually a bit better than more in the sense that you can also move backwards in files. But basically, all these things do one thing. And they do it really well. And other programs can use these programs that do one thing really well as part of their operation. So a lot of these programs are contained in what are known as packages. You can install this software, these software packages, from centralized repos, centralized repositories, on Debian and Debian-based distributions, which includes Ubuntu and Fedora, which the cloud runs. You can run aptitude. Apt-get install package will install a program, install a package for you. If you want a web server, you can do apt-get install Apache 2. It will take care of all the dependencies, all the files that Apache 2, all the programs that Apache 2 needs to run, install those for you, and install Apache 2. And that's it. It'll work. If you want OpenOffice, which is sort of like Microsoft Office, except open source and for Linux, you can use apt-get install openoffice.org, and it will handle the installation for you. Now, we talked before about different distributions. So different distributions will come with different packages installed by default. If you get a server distribution, like the one that the cloud runs, CS50's cloud, it'll probably have a web server installed by default. It probably won't have openoffice.org installed by default. In general, if you're on a server, you're not going to be needing to run an OpenOffice document editor, but you know there's a good chance you're going to be hosting websites. If you get Ubuntu or another distribution meant for personal use, it's very likely to have openoffice.org installed. Most personal users do some kind of document editing. But it probably won't have things like a web server installed, because most users won't be hosting websites. So we have a lot of individual programs, but how do we actually do anything useful? So, you know, it's great to be able to, you know, look at a file or change file permissions, but that's not actually doing much useful. So the way we do useful things is with pipes. So pipes allow programs to communicate with each other. And in technical terms, it sends standard out of one program to standard in of another. So we talked before, earlier in the course, about file streams and opening files and how standard in is what you input into your program and standard out is what your program outputs. Pipes allow you to redirect this output automatically so that what goes output of one program will become the input of the next program. So as an example, I have three examples up here. We have last less, last piped to less, which the last command shows you the last logged in users, the last users who've logged into your system, the output of which can be very long if you have a lot of users. The pipe sends the output of last to the program less, which displays the output in a readable format. So it displays it and allows you to scroll among it. This is a principle. Last doesn't need to incorporate a nice way of showing the text. It just sends it to standard out, and less will handle the output for you. We have find dot slash name thumbs.db delete. This says I want to find all the files from my current directory named thumbs.db and delete them. The last one, which is more funny than useful, calls two programs, fortune, which just outputs a random fortune, and cowsay, which puts it in a speech bubble said by a cow. Now, keep in mind that the output of cowsay is just going to standard out, so you could have done fortune pipe cowsay pipe cowsay, and it would show you a picture of a cow saying a speech bubble that contained a cow saying a speech bubble that said, it's all in the mind, you know. So it's very flexible, can be used for good things, and can be used for completely pointless things. So how do you actually access the kernel? How do you use Linux? Where do we type in these things? Where do we type in things that we're going to run as programs? And the answer to this is the shell. So the shell is your interface between you and the kernel. There have been many shells throughout history, throughout the history of Linux. Different shells do different things well. Cloud.cs50.net uses the bash shell. Fast uses the bash shell. So in general, we'll be talking about the bash shell. It's a little bit of a tongue twister. We have these things called environment variables. And environment variables control the characteristics of your shell. You can view them with env or dollar sign variable. So if you used echo dollar sign and then a variable, that would output the variable to your terminal. You can set them with export. So for example, ps1 is an environment variable that sets your prompt. So if you did export ps1 equals mycoolprompt colon, every line, instead of starting with your username at cloud or the default prompt on the cloud, would say mycoolprompt colon and allow you to type something. So that's kind of pointless, but you can put things in your prompt like the current time, or you can change the color so that it's easier to see, make it stand out. There are other variables. Your home variable contains the directory, the path of your home directory. The path variable contains which directories the shell should search when it wants to run a program. And if you use export, these variables have to be set each time. So we have files. Notice they're hidden files. They start with a dot. Dot profile and dot bash profile, for example. These allow you to set environment variables each time you log into a shell, each time you log into a system. So we have variables. We have programs that can be strung together with pipes. We can make our own programs. And that's what makes Linux awesome. So we'll go back to shell scripts. Shell scripts are programs that are completely uncompiled, like PHP, and they're read line by line and executed by the shell. They typically, by convention, end in .sh, but that's in no way a requirement. They have to be chmodded executable, executable being the one. So you would chmod it, for example, 700 if you only yourself be able to run it, 711 if you want everybody to be able to run it. And they start with a shebang, which tells the shell what to use to interpret this bash script. So for example, if we're writing a bash script using the bash programming language, we would do hash bang bin bash, where remember bin is the directory that contains binary files and bash is your shell. It's also a binary file program. And so the shebang at the beginning tells the computer to use bash to interpret the script. So a quick overview of bash scripting so you guys can see what this is like. We have a very easy hello world program. So it starts out with a shebang that tells the computer to use bin bash to interpret it, and it just contains echo hello world. Outputs hello world to the screen, that's all it does. Not very interesting. But it's also flexible, and it can do other things. So this is an example of a program written in both C and bash. Note that the bash program you can just run, whereas the C program you'll have to compile first. They both store the number 3 in a variable called number. They store Bob in a variable called name. And they output your name is your chosen name, and number is your chosen number. They increment this number, increase it by 1, and then if the incremented variable is equal to 4, it outputs addition works like a charm. So both of these programs will output addition works like a charm. They are just two different programming languages used for doing the same thing. Now, bash executes this script line by line, which means that you can type those lines into your terminal, and it would do the same thing as putting it in a bash script and executing that script. So a few differences to point out. In bash, all variables are strings. So this is an interesting design decision, but it's what you have to work with. So all variables are strings. In C, variables can be multiple types, and they must be declared before they're used. Whereas in bash scripting, we just assigned a variable. In C, you have to give a variable a type. You have to define a variable type before you can store anything into it. In bash, variables are accessed with dollar sign. In C, they don't have prefixes. Bash runs other Linux programs to do its work. So you notice how over here we had echo name is your chosen name. Echo is a Linux program that outputs the string. Whereas in C, it runs subroutines or functions from libraries to do work. So it doesn't execute other programs. It can, but in general, it executes other functions that you or someone else has written in C to do its work. In bash, spacing matters. So it uses new lines to know when there's a new terminal. And in C, spacing pretty much doesn't matter, which goes along with bash not having line endings. When you go to a new line, that's how bash knows it's a new command. And in C, statements end in the semicolon, which means that, as I said before, spacing doesn't really matter because it judges the end of a command by the semicolon. So there are many similarities, and they boil down to the fact that bash is a programming language in and of itself. So it's a shell that allows you to interact with the kernel, but it's a lot more than just you typing in commands. It's, in fact, a programming language. And you can use it to put together these pieces of Linux in a way that suit your needs. And it's fundamentally your computer to control, which is one of the big Linux philosophies. So over here is a complex bash program, which you don't have to understand in great detail. It's basically showing how you can use bash as glue code, or code that links two programs together. So this uses the two Linux programs, inotifywait and rsync, with a lot of different options. And basically, it waits for changes to files, which is what inotifywait does, and then uses rsync to sync them with a remote server. So this is basically a way for the computer to do things by itself, more complex than one program running would be able to do. And it allows you complete control and customability. So we have in Linux, as I said before, a focus on the command line, and a GUI, a GUI interface, is often secondary. And we have a lot of people using Linux. We have Trinity from The Matrix using Linux, and we have security professionals using Linux, personal computers that run Linux. Here's an example. of something you can't actually do, attempting to exploit SSH, dot, 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 successful. You know, we don't really do things like this. Then you think, you know, that can't be done by point and click, and then it can. So this is a program called Wireshark, and you guys have probably heard about FireSheep, which allows you to intercept sessions from other websites. This is a program that actually captures these raw packets being sent over the network. So when you're sitting in Starbucks on your laptop using Wi-Fi with a bunch of other people, it's the equivalent of every computer screaming out everything it's sending to the internet. So if I'm sitting there and doing Google searches, my computer is screaming out the Google searches I'm doing, screaming out which Facebook pages I'm going to. These are all contained in packets, which are sent across the network. And this software allows you to view all the packets. So this is sort of a tangent, a side note, but point and click is useful for things. It's very useful for things like this, which would just be a pain to use over the command line. So we've been staring a lot at text consoles. But as I said, Linux does allow for graphics. X11 on NICE, which is the main login server that FAST uses for students, and on the cloud, you can use this X11 forwarding, which allows you to run programs on the servers and look at them on your desktop. So if you log in, if you SSH to a server and use a option when you're SSHing, from a Mac it's -y, you can then run programs such as Firefox or Emacs, the text editor, and they'll appear as windows on your own computer. This works by default out of the box on Macs and requires extra configuration for Windows because it's not a Unix or Unix-like operating system. But it is a very cool way to access programs on other servers using a visual interface. If you're running Linux locally, there are two main window managers, GNOME and KDE. And these window managers allow for the display of graphics. You can try these in the Science Center computers. You can try these on your own computers. Ubuntu, Red Hat, they all have window managers because you do want to use a graphical system if you're actually using a computer. So some interesting programs with graphics, obviously Firefox, that's the main open source web browser. We have Wireshark, as I mentioned before, it's a packet analyzer. VNC is a program that transmits the keyboard and the mouse from one computer to another over the network and duplicates the graphical screen updates over the network. So for example, if I have my laptop over here and I go to China and leave my laptop open, I can use a keyboard and mouse from a computer in China. Well, maybe not China, because they have some firewall stuff. But if I go to a India and I want to access my computer, I could use my keyboard and mouse in India, do things on my computer, and the display of my computer will be put on my computer screen in India. Simple as that. You know, we have other software, XAOS, which displays fractals. Some are useful, some are just for fun. Just like in any operating system, GIMP is a graphics editor that a lot of people use, an open source graphics editor. So we've talked about programs and distributions, but what actually is a distribution? So a distribution is a complete way of running Linux. So in general, it contains a command line interface, CLI, and graphical user interface. In general, it contains GNOME or KDE for the graphical user interface. The command line interface is built around the Linux kernel, and it's built around other things, other libraries, the GNU C library, the GNU C compiler, and it is, as we said before, where a lot of the main stuff on a Linux distribution happens. So finally, I encourage everybody to try out Linux in a way more than just SSHing to a CS50 server. which you can basically just use but not actually do very much on because you don't have administrative access. You don't have to erase your hard drive or even modify your hard drive to run Linux. You can run Linux in what's called a virtual machine, VM. There is free software to do this, VirtualBox. There's also paid software. And it allows you to run Linux inside a window of your current operating system. And you can full screen it so it looks like you're actually running the operating system, but in fact, it is a virtual machine in that it is actually a program running inside another operating system. You can use Linux as a live CD, which is actually a really cool way to try out distributions. So you burn a CD or DVD, and you put it in your drive, and you can boot from it and actually do stuff running off your CD-ROM. And it's a great way to experiment with different distributions, see what works for you, see what looks good, just to try it out. You can also install it alongside your current operating system, and it's called dual booting, or if you install more, triple booting. And it allows you to select which operating system you want to start up when your computer turns on. So, for example, I dual boot with Windows and the Mac operating system, and I run Linux in a virtual machine. It allows me to use all these different operating systems for different purposes. The internet is your friend. There are lots of forums and lots of email lists talking about Linux and everything to do with Linux. So if you need help, there are tens of thousands of people waiting around their computers to help you out. It's a great community. And different distributions and different software packages obviously have different types of communities. Ubuntu has a very welcoming beginner community and has a very active Ubuntu forums to help out newcomers to Linux, whereas some of the more upper level or difficult to learn distributions tend to rely on their users having a significant Linux knowledge base before attempting to use them. There's also a lot of interesting history to do with Linux and Unix in general. Wikipedia has great resources on this. You can also just Google around. There's a lot to find. And fundamentally, if you are ever confused about how a program works, use the manual. Even if it's something as simple as how LS works, maybe you want to give it certain options to show hidden files, use colors, man LS. It will show you everything you need to know. So thank you very much for listening, and I hope you now have a better understanding of what Linux is and how you can use it on your own computer. Thanks.